The next case is 07-1961, Disciplinary Counsel versus J. Allen Goldblatt.
Not sure how to proceed after all the body parts stuff. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Supreme Court, my name is Lawrence Turbo, and I represent the respondent in this matter, Jay Goldblatt. Probably is overreaching to remind the court that the primary purpose of the disciplinary system is to punish, is not to punish the offender, but to protect the public. I'm here today to object solely to the Board of Commissioners' recommendation of an indefinite suspension with no retroactivity. I do not object, and we do not object to the Board's finding of two violations. We at the time moved to dismiss the violation of 1102A4, and the Board panel and Board of Commissioners agreed and dismissed that charge. We never protested or objected to the other two charges. Mr. Goldblatt has not practiced law since November 9, 2005. He submitted a letter to the Supreme Court requesting inactive status on November 11, 2005, and was placed on inactive status by the court on November 22, 2005. This was followed by an interim suspension issued by the court on January 27, 2006, which, of course, continues through today. The proceedings before the Board of Commissioners on Grievance and Discipline were extended by a stay of proceedings that was placed in effect at the request of the Office of Disciplinary Counsel on or about April the 3rd, 2006, and continued until April the 2nd, 2007. Those are maybe within a day or so. When Mr. Goldblatt's appeals to the 8th District Court of Appeals and to this court were exhausted, the Board of Commissioners then placed the case back on the active track. Please note that the stay before the Board of Commissioners was not requested by the respondent. In fact, the respondent was prepared and advised the panel chair that we were prepared to go forward with the disciplinary process even while the appeal was pending in the 8th District. The practical effect of this stay, however, is that Mr. Goldblatt's interim suspension has been extended by at least 12 months. The Board of Commissioners has recommended, as I said before, an indefinite suspension with retroactivity. I have read many of the cases decided by this court, and I'm aware that this court must review and does review each of these very significant cases independently. And in cases involving felony convictions, such as this one, generally issues either a lengthy definite suspension, often 2 years or more, often 2 years, or an indefinite suspension. In many of those cases, this court then has to determine whether or not to grant retroactivity. Mr. Goldblatt did at the time and maintains that the appropriate suspension should be a definite suspension. However, the panel and the board in its deliberations felt that an indefinite suspension would be more appropriate. However, by doing so, and by recommending no retroactivity, Mr. Goldblatt's first opportunity to come back to this court and seek reinstatement would be an additional 2 years, meaning that his license would have been suspended for in excess of 4 years. Now, of course, we know that when he does apply, because if there were indefinite suspension, he would not necessarily automatically be reinstated. It appears to me, and it is clear, that Mr. Goldblatt's interim suspension was extended, at least in part, by virtue of he exercising his right to appeal the criminal conviction in the trial court. It appears to me that it is inappropriate that Mr. Goldblatt suffer an additional punishment of this additional time, which the court could determine to be between 1 and 2 years, because he chose to exercise his rights to appeal on what I am told was a very close question under the law, being the question that was appealed to the court. Apparently, it was even closer than I had thought before in determining that recently the Ninth District Court of Appeals has issued an opinion that's in direct contracts and is contrary to the Eighth District decision in the Goldblatt matter, and in fact, cert has been requested because of the conflict in jurisdictions to this court.
Counsel, what was the issue that was appealed?
I
understood this was a plea agreement.
Are you asking what the issue on the appeal was?
So what would the issue on appeal be?
I was not the criminal attorney, but as I understand, the issue on appeal has to do with whether or not you have to have a real victim. The underlying case that Mr. Goldblatt was convicted of compelling prostitution on had to do with talking on the telephone with someone who advised Mr. Goldblatt he was
officer.
A pimp. In fact, he was a special agent of the federal investigation, and that there was in fact no victim. There was in fact no victim. The Eighth District Court of Appeals apparently just determined that, much like an attempted rape statute, where there does not have to be an actual victim. I'm getting pretty far afield here from what I know, so this is my supposition, that you don't have to have an actual victim for compelling prostitution. The Ninth District Court of Appeals, in a case called Bartram, which this panel may or may not get, determined in their majority opinion that in fact the compelling prostitution statute would require an actual victim, and that since there was no victim, that in the Bartram case that conviction could not be sustained.
Mr. Turbo, your client has been registered as a sexually oriented offender, is that correct? With the new community notification, is that going to eventually affect his ability to practice law in the future?
Well, I have a feeling that in a few years a whole posse of lawyers is going to be standing before here arguing about that. Mr. Goldblatt was not classified in one of those three classifications by the trial court. I have the entry here, and I could find it. However, it is my understanding that under the new Adam Walsh Act, he is required to register. It is further my understanding that an appeal of that has been filed by Mr. Goldblatt, as well as many, many others. It's my understanding just yesterday that the Court of Common Pleas of Cuyahoga County has created a special docket anticipating an awful lot of those appeals. I'd like to tell the court that in further support of my request that the court consider retroactivity in this case, that there isn't any question that Mr. Goldblatt has been a model member of the Ohio Legal Assistance Plan, of which he is under contract. Mr. Kamey had testified, and there was no question about that. Dr. Stephen Levine, who is a recognized expert in sexual dysfunction, a clinical professor of psychiatry at the Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine, the co-director of the Center of Marital and Sexual Health, and one of the directors of a program entitled Program for Professionals, and a doctor that has been consulted by at least two arms of this Ohio Supreme Court, that of Bar Admissions and the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, and been used by them to evaluate and make recommendations with respect to individuals who have been accused of sexual dysfunction or in the workplace or in relation to their profession, has stated and did state that in his medical opinion, he believed that Mr. Goldblatt could resume his legal career now and that he is at low risk to reoffend. Dr. Levine did not state and would not state that he should be returned to the practice.
Counsel, what was the nature of his practice?
Of Mr. Goldblatt's practice?
Yes.
Mr. Goldblatt was corporate counsel to a company. He has one, therefore he has no or one client in his practice. There is no question that in doing that, there's no allegation or any inference that he ever caused any harm to that or any other client. There's no allegation that, to this day, on a PRN basis, that company does consult him and does employ him on matters that are not legal, not directly legal services.
So there's nothing about the nature of his work in the past. In other words, if he got back in, perhaps he can go back to the company that he worked for, but perhaps he'd be looking for work. His past experience his practice didn't involve handling domestic cases or juveniles or where he would be.
I think his only experience with domestic practice was his own divorce.
Okay, so we wouldn't want to be putting him back in to then handle young women in his practice.
From what I understand, Mr. Goldblatt is a fairly gifted corporate attorney, and that's where his years of expertise would be. And one would anticipate that whether he were to go back to his corporate, the company that previously employed him, or in some other practice, that it would strictly be transactional. It would be corporate. It would have to do with purchasing and selling businesses and properties.
Counsel, I have a question with you for you about Dr. Levine's testimony. Apparently, his first impression, the doctor's first impression, was that the victim here was a teenager. And according to our information, the respondent failed to fully disclose the charges or the situation, namely the age of the intended victim here. And then that was something that the doctor was concerned about. And actually, I'm not sure from what we have whether the doctor revised his or this recommendation is based on the knowledge that the victim was as young as 9 or 10.
May I be permitted? I had a conversation with the doctor about that, and if I may be permitted to say so. There appeared, when one of the panel members, who happens to be a county prosecutor, examined the doctor, he asked him about the age of the victims, of the intended victim. The doctor made statements. I don't have the transcript. I think that Ms. Costa does with her. He made some statements that he was of the impression that the intended child was older. I do believe he also said that his recommendations and his evaluations would not change because they were based upon all of the actions and all of the steps that Mr. Goldblatt had taken post-arrest, being that he engaged in an AA program, sexual offenders. He engaged in private psychotherapy. He engaged a psychiatrist. He engaged in family therapy. He immediately...
Do you know if he was upfront with those therapists and mental health professionals about the nature of his offense?
To the best of my knowledge, he was.
But you don't know?
Well, it's my understanding that post-hearing, Dr. Levine looked at his notes a little bit more. I mean, this is really kind of out there. His notes a bit more, and he was perfectly confident that Mr. Goldblatt had been fully upfront with him. And for reasons that I hope the court can understand, Dr. Levine did not speak to Mrs. Risen, who was the primary therapist, Mrs. Risen being a noted authority on this sort of thing in the state of Ohio. They are in the same practice, as an attorney would say, a Chinese wall was built simply for that reason. Now, someone asked why we went to Dr. Levine. We went to Dr. Levine because he's one of the noted one or two authorities in the country in these sorts of things, and has written 20-some books and extensively. I believe my time is up, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Turbo. Ms. Costa.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Carol Costa on behalf of disciplinary counsel. The panel and the board unanimously concluded that an indefinite suspension is warranted in this case with no credit for time served. We believe that that decision should be affirmed here today. The cases cited by respondent all deal with crimes involving things like cocaine, assault in a domestic dispute between a husband and wife, violations of federal antitrust law. Not one of those cases deal with a crime involving someone who is trying to arrange a sexual tryst with a minor that he believed was going to be 11 or 12 years old. I would ask the court to take a look at Exhibit 9 that was submitted at the hearing beginning on page 23. That sets forth the transcript of the tape recordings of the telephone conversations respondent had with the undercover agent. The undercover agent asked what ages respondent was interested in. He said the younger, the better. The agent told respondent he could arrange meetings with infants on up. Respondent responded, really, they do stuff.
Ms. Costa, are you making the point that this is a crime of moral turpitude within the meaning of the disciplinary code?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that is not disputed by respondent in this case. This is a heinous crime, and respondent argues essentially because he has been undergoing treatment that he deserves a break. His break, Your Honor, is that case precedent in these types of circumstances doesn't warrant disbarment.
What about the argument that the disciplinary process was put on hold pending the appeal? Is there any merit to the fact that we have extended the suspension, his suspension with a felony pending that he was placed on at that particular point?
The felony suspension was in January of 2006. The rules specifically say, Gov Bar Rules 5 specifically says, until all appeals are exhausted, you can't proceed to a hearing. That's what the rule is. And in this case, obviously, everything was affirmed on appeal. Had it not been, and I think that's the purpose of the rule, had it not been affirmed on appeal, or if something had been changed, maybe our position would have taken a different approach. So I disagree wholeheartedly with respondent's counsel on that point, Your Honor. In this case, and in the cases that were cited by the panel members in their opinion, this is a case of first impression here. And I think it's time that the court tells attorneys, tells the public, that we will not tolerate this type of conduct. We're not saying that respondent can never get back in, but we're saying he has to continue with his treatment program and prove to you that he's fit to not only be a member of the profession, but to protect the public, which is all of our roles. And I would also like to just point out that there is no evidence in the record of respondent's treatment records from his treating psychologist, Dr. Risen. There's no evidence at all from her. He did meet for several hours with Dr. Levine, who came to conclusions that were set forth in the transcript. But Dr. Levine also testified very clearly that respondent was not forthright in some of the things that he told them about the situation. And I think based upon all of this evidence set forth in the record that an indefinite with no credit is appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Costa. Mr. Turbo, you saved just about a minute of your time.
Your Honors, punishment for this heinous crime was dealt with by Judge Burnside. When I opened up, this court needs to take into consideration in protecting the public and bringing honor to the profession. But punishment for the crime which Ms. Costa now asks you to extend by extending his suspension, is not, at least in my humble opinion, an element that this court need consider.
Well, she's just asked us to follow the board's recommendation and to do what we ordinarily do, and if we do indefinite, we do indefinite. We don't say the clock started running some time ago. Well, I'd compliment you on your resourcefulness today. I read your objections and thought we're going to be in and out of here in no time. You said respondent files this objection solely for the purpose of securing a hearing to make himself available to the court through his counsel to answer any questions of the court. You did a good deal more than that.
Yes, I did. But I have two other points to make, and that is, to the best of my knowledge, I could find no cases decided by this court that had to do with an interim suspension in which there was an appeal. One case that this court may have considered, because I can't really tell by reading it, is the case of Disciplinary Counsel versus Blazak, which is 2004-1374, because it does mention, although he conditioned it upon an appeal because he claimed that his testimony was truthful, I don't know what that's all about, but the court ultimately granted retroactivity in that case. I don't know if that was because of the appeal or not, but that
Counsel,
question was asked.
To rain on your parade just a little bit more, Chief's been here longer than I. I've been here 15 years, and I can only recall a handful. I'm not sure I can even recall a handful of people that we gave indefinite to that we actually left back in. Most people who get indefinite don't even try. I mean, they move on with their life. They've got the legal education. They find other ways to be productive citizens without asking us to reinstate. Now, maybe your client, that's his whole focus, is getting back in. But the reality is, most find other employment that doesn't require them to be a licensed lawyer.
Well, whether you know, as I understand it, indefinite suspension, just because the suspension, the 2 years runs, the court still has the opportunity, right, and duty to independently determine whether or not that's somebody that they're interested in reinstating.
Right. What I'm saying to you is most don't ask after they've gone through this
process.
But I
believe that my job is to try and preserve that right for Mr. Goldblatt so he can determine whether or not he wishes to ask and then prove sufficiently to this court.
And I'm just suggesting in counseling a person facing that, that it would be useful to them in their lives to suggest there's, you know, a lot of people you went to law school with never practiced law a day of their life, and they've had a happy and productive and financially successful life, and I think that point probably needs to be made to anyone who finds himself in this degree of difficulty with the rules. My speech.
I certainly understand that, and I think that most people facing these consequences understand that. But I believe that Mr. Goldblatt should at least be given the retroactivity of the 12 months or so that his appeal was pending. By exercising his rights, he extends his period, and that's really why I'm here.
Thank you, Mr. Turbo. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion tomorrow.